Many, many years ago, I was in home church with our speakers today, Joe and Cindy Boddy. And there was lots of young families in that group. And if I remember correctly, we had four families that all had four boys in that church. We also had 54 kids under the age of 10 in that group. I remember we had like a nursing room, so we had a baby monitor going so you could listen to the teaching with the other nursing moms.
Yeah.
So it was crazy, but it was also such a great time to be with other parents in the same life situation, do ministry together. So I just encourage any of you, if you're not connected with the home group, it's such a great thing, great support for you. So Joe and Cindy have continued to be involved with young families for 30-plus years in ministry here at our church. In addition to raising their three kids, they've been heavily involved in junior high, high school, college. They're leading college right now, right? And Joe has been our student ministries division coordinator for 27 years. And in addition to all the things Cindy's done, she's also been a teacher at Calumet for 14 years. That sounds about right. Language arts teacher. So all that to say, they have had lots of experience interacting with kids and parents and seen a lot of things and have a lot of experience to bring today. So they want to share with us some thoughts on styles of parenting. Do you know you have a style of parenting? We'll find that out today. And it really does have a huge impact on our families and on our kids. So we are really thankful they're going to share that with us today. So why don't I pray and we'll have them come up. God, I just thank you for everybody in this room. Gosh, we're all so different parents. We have many different kids with different needs and different backgrounds. And I just thank you that you know them all and you can handle everything that we have, all our concerns about parenting. You can handle it and you can give us the wisdom we need. I know just leaving the hospital with my first child, I was like, I don't know what I'm doing. Help me, God. And you certainly have provided so much through your word, through the body of Christ. And so I just really thank you for Joe and Cindy and their willingness to share with us what they've learned. And I just pray your spirit will speak to each of us through this morning. Amen.
Amen. Good morning. We are going to show a couple videos, and then Cindy's going to get up and talk, and then after she presents some stuff, then I'll get up and talk. Authoritative parenting. Well, let's take a look at video. Oh, being in control without damaging the relationship. Maybe some of you have seen this before.
When you feel the first signs of a cold, use Vicks First Defense. It's a new microgel that attacks the cold virus before it has a chance to turn nasty. New Vicks First Defense. Attack is the best form of defense.
There's a style. Yeah, how do you like that? Okay, this one's a little bit longer. And maybe you've seen this one. It's the where the kid slaps his mom in the Dr. Phil show.
Right my arm, and that hurt. You don't give me the right to strike me with your elbow.
Dude, the first time you went like that to me, I ignored it. And you jabbed me again.
I didn't jab you.
And I could see where it was going and what I said to you, and this was a word of warning.
I jabbed you. I did not jab you. You jabbed me.
I was petrified. And what I said to you is physical acts of aggression get taken very seriously on an airplane. If you begin to get aggressive, they will put handcuffs on you.
I was getting your attention. I did this. I was tapping your arm with my elbow. You went like that.
I had told you on more than one occasion that I wasn't putting the volume down.
Well, you know what? I kept asking because it was driving me crazy.
So then you decided to do this. And after the second one, I gave you one back as a way to say, stop it.
So you said, that's enough?
Exactly.
No, yeah, you got my attention, but I'm not a dog.
So why don't you heed my suggestions of stop it when I ask politely?
Because you're not the complete boss of me. I control my body, I control what I do, and you don't have the right to hit me that hard. I lightly tapped your arm with my elbow. Stop, let me talk. I lightly tapped your arm with my elbow to get your attention. Bam! Right in my arm. It actually left a mark for about 20 minutes. But 20 minutes later, it was finally
fading. Okay, backing up, you said you're not the boss of me. I am the boss of you. When a mother says to be quiet, she's the boss of you, and you need to listen to that. Bottom line.
I never said...
When a teacher says something, she's the boss of you, and you
Shut
need to listen.
Shut up! Give me a turn to speak! Fine, see? You do that to me! How does it feel? How does it feel to be told to shut up?
We've talked about
it. Let me speak! How does that feel?
Do not.
How does that feel?
Do not put your hands on me. Do you understand me?
Do you understand me?
No, I asked you a question.
You know what? Shut up! Apparently that's the only word that gets your attention. How does that make you feel?
I, of course, always knew that there was an incredible amount of rage and anger there, but the depths of it surprised me. And of course, when he raised his hand and slapped me across the face, that absolutely surprised me.
I did lightly slap her on the cheek to show her how that feels. So I hope that that made her think about what she does. You know what? You be nice to me, I'll be nice to you, but it'll never end if you continue to be mean. I try to apologize, saying, you know what, Mom, I should not have said that, and I am sorry. And then you come back with, well, all I'm trying to do is treat you nicely. I'm just trying to be nice to you. That's mean! I just really, really need somewhere to stay other than with my mom. I really need somewhere else to stay.
Whoa, 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 that is not even almost okay.
All right. There's a style we don't want. She was not in control. This morning, I'm Cindy, by the way. This morning, we're going to define different parenting styles, and maybe you've heard these in psychology class, but it's always good to review because we slip into old styles often. We're going to talk about the importance of connection and discipline. Good warmth, bad warmth, and good discipline, effective discipline, and bad discipline. But before we start, here's our family. Daniel on the far is 21. Michelle is next. She's 26, and Jenny on the end is 24, and is married to Tyler. And so, you know, we're empty nesters now, but we were in your shoes at one point, and there is a light at the end of the tunnel. But we are not experts, by all means, we are not. We're going to share a lot of our failures today with you that hopefully you can learn from where we made mistakes. We came from dysfunctional homes. Our dads were alcoholics. I came from a divorced home, an abusive father. And so, you know, you go into parenting very scared, like, what the heck? How do I do this? How do I not repeat what was done? And that's where God is involved. God is involved in your families, and that's what you got to remember. If you have Jesus Christ in your life, then you have the God of the universe involved in your family, and he is for your family. And we have to parent under grace. If we don't parent under grace, we are going to do more damage to our kids. You know, they don't come with a manual when you have your baby, you know, whether it's adoption or whether it's through birth. They don't come with a manual like, this is how you're supposed to parent me. We've never done this before, so how are we supposed to know how to do this? And then you think, you get the one figured out, pretty much, sort of, and then the other one comes along completely opposite, and you're like, okay, I need a new manual. So this is why you have to have God involved, because he knows, he designed your kids, so he knows how they need to be parented, and you need to be under grace, because you've never done it before, and he knows that. And so he's going to guide you. So keep that in mind as we're going over these things so that, you know, if you get that guilt feeling coming in, you know, don't go there. You're under grace. Just like your kids grow, you grow. We are going to be quoting a lot from this book, Price of Privilege. Madeline Levine is a psychiatrist out of Chicago. Very well known. Excellent book. It's a lot for teenagers, but it's got real good principles. So the two factors that she says that all parents need are connection with their kids and then discipline, and we're going to go through each of those.
She says, while both connection and discipline on their own are important parenting factors, what is really predictive of how well kids do is the interaction of these two factors. So when we go through these four parenting styles, you'll see how the connection and discipline work. So I have this chart. High connection, low discipline, high discipline. And each of the different types of parenting styles follow in these. So, for example, permissive has low discipline, high connection, high relationship. Whereas authoritarian has low connection and high discipline. Disengaged has low discipline, low connection, worst one. And then what we're aiming for is high connection and high discipline, authoritative. So let's go over permissive. Permissive is where a parent wants to be the friend to the child, okay? And they're extremely involved, so there's a high connection, high warmth with the child, but very reluctant to discipline because that's going to rock the boat. That's going to disturb that friendship. And their goal is to want to make the child happy. And so, you know, obviously when you discipline a child, they're not happy. So they avoid that. Rules are erratically enforced. They're not consistent in their rules. Child has little responsibilities. By the way, if you're trying to take notes and you want it sent out, we can send you this so that you don't have to worry about note-taking. And if their child is misbehaved in some way and a fellow friend or a teacher comes to you and says, you know, your child is out of control or whatever, usually what is said in this permissiveness is, oh, she's just going through a stage. Or the teacher did a lousy job teaching that material. My Johnny would have done great on that quiz if she would have taught well. That's a permissive parent. This is what Levine says about that. Children of permissive parents tend to be likable, social, and enjoy high self-esteem. On the other hand, they tend to be impulsive, immature, and have difficulty understanding the consequences of their actions. These children tend to be manipulative and have lower rates of academic achievement and higher rates of substance abuse, which is something we really want to avoid. All right, so the authoritarian is more like the militant. You know, they run their house like a military. Do as you are told. Strict, inflexible set of rules. Not interested in the child's point of view. It's like my way or hit the highway. Enforced swiftly without any kind of discussion. Very controlling, high demands, high expectations, not responsive to the child or the child's needs, more cold than warm toward the child, and you'll hear this, because I said so, you know, the child comes up and says, why do I need to do this? And the authoritarian parent would be like, because I said so. I'm the parent. You're not. And granted, there are times when you do need to do that, but if you're doing that all the time, that's not good. Levine says, unfortunately, many children from authoritarian homes have low self-esteem, poor social skills, high rates of depression. In addition, they lack curiosity. These children often remain overly dependent on others for guidance and control. Children from authoritarian homes are more aggressive than children from families with other parenting styles. And this is really a scary quote. Authoritarian homes with their one-way emphasis on power can provide a breeding ground for bullies. We do not want to raise a bully. All right, disengaged. Low discipline, low connection. Not warm. No demands placed on the child. Minimal interaction. Pretty much indifferent to their needs and whereabouts. Don't want to be bothered by the child. This is the worst parenting style. And I can guarantee there's probably no one in here that does this, because you wouldn't be in this parenting meeting if you were this style. But sometimes you can feel this way and go in this style, and it is the worst. I had a high school girl that I discipled many years ago, and this was the kind of home that she came from. And she could not, because she was her own boss, she had no boundaries. She could do whatever she wanted. She'd come and go as she pleased. And she could not put a walk together with Christ because of that. She couldn't put her life under any kind of authority. And so she's currently really out there. It's really sad. Research shows that children of neglectful or disengaged parents are more susceptible to impulsive behavior, delinquency, addictions due to issues with self-regulation, and they also have an increased risk in suicidal behavior in adolescents, which is scary. We're seeing more and more from people that don't have Jesus Christ in their life have this kind of parenting style. It's really scary. And we can make a difference by parenting differently. Authoritative. This is our aim. We want to have a warm and accepting type of connection with our kids, yet we want to have clear, defined limits and expectations. We want to place a high value on cooperation, social responsibility, and self-regulation. We want to promote independence. We don't want them at 28 still living in our house, living in our basement. We want to promote independence with this type of style. And parents meet the child's needs when it's needed. And parents don't get their needs met by their child. Many of the other types of styles, you're getting your needs met by your child, and that's not healthy. Levine says authoritative parenting is not simply middle of the road. So this isn't a type of style that's like, oh, in the middle of all these others. It is a totally unique, different style than the others. She says, research shows that children from authoritative families have more balanced attitudes about achievement, better social skills, higher grades, lower rates of substance abuse, and less depression than children of other styles. So that's what we want. So now I'm going to talk about the connection. What does that look like to have a high, warm connection with your kids? Well, a lot of authors call it parental warmth. It's just basically a relationship with your child. And there's a continuum on either end. We are trying to avoid these two extremes. The one extreme is over-involvement, intrusion, enmeshment, bad praise, and the other extreme is criticism and rejection. We want, and those are bad warmth, we want the optimal connection. We want something in the middle there. And this is her definition of warmth. Warmth is the quality of involvement, understanding, acceptance, and love that parents communicate on different levels, and ever-evolving ways as their children grow. This has to change as your children get older. You don't treat, you know, you're not warm towards a baby the way you would be toward a teenager. They would be like, get out of here. So the warmth changes as they grow. Children with warmth, connected parents are better adjusted. And, you know, it helps discipline too, which Joe will go into. So how do you have this kind of warmth? Well, the first thing is you got to have acceptance of your child. Acceptance doesn't mean that you have to like your son's pierced ears or nose or your daughter, well, I have one, but your daughter's tattoo. It does mean, however, that in spite of inevitable disagreements and disappointments, the essence of your child remains dear to you. So this is that principle from 1 Peter 4 where, above all else, love covers a multitude of sins. You can communicate somehow that you accept and love your children. Even if you don't agree with them, even if you're disappointed in what they're doing, you can still communicate that warmth. Don't compare. This will totally communicate to them bad warmth. This is where you're not accepting them. You're comparing, whether it's to your friend's kids, whether it's to another sibling, you know, why is this one able to do this and take risks and this one isn't? You know, why aren't you like this one? That will kill any kind of warmth with your child. They'll pick that up and they'll, you know, it'll be bad. I like what Swindoll, this is a really good book, You and Your Child, and he says, in every child God places in our arms, there's a bent. A set of characteristics already established. You know, they come with their own personality, the way God designed them. The bent is fixed and determined before it's even given to our care. The child is not, in fact, a pliable piece of clay. We don't change their personality. He has been set and he has been bent. And so we need to accept the way our kids were made and communicate that acceptance to them. Another way to communicate warmth is a deep understanding. You know, with our friends, we listen long enough to know what it feels like to be in their shoes. But what happens with our kids? Why do we all of a sudden drop that? Instead, we go often with our children, we rush in to offer suggestions and propose alternatives or solve the problems. And, you know, this was my weakness. This is what I tended to do. And what was underneath that was my problem was I don't want my child to feel sad and unhappy. And so I don't want him to feel that way because that makes me feel that way. And that makes me feel bad. And so I try and fix them. And that is just, that will kill any kind of understanding. I'm not seeking to understand my child by doing that. Levine says, unfortunately, when we intervene prematurely, we lose the opportunity to understand a bit more how about our particular child, about who our particular child is and how developed her skills for approaching a challenging situation. There's nothing more reassuring or more likely to encourage connection and communication with our children than our inviting listening presence. We need to listen to them and draw them out, and this is not easy, especially when you're in a rush. We also need to communicate commitment, and that's really, you know, you think about your relationship with God. If you have that, God communicates that to us. He says, I'll never leave you or forsake you. That gets a connection, and we need to communicate that to our children. Children need to be protected, not just comforted. They need to know we are there on their team, on their side. They need to know that we won't be emotionally abandoning them. You know, we aren't going to give up on them, that you're in their court rooting for them. They need to know that. So this acceptance, this deep understanding, this commitment, all takes time to build. And we're in a culture of rush. Hurry. Come on, let's get your, you know, we got to get our kid to school. And, you know, we are in a total hurry, hurry, hurry culture. And this takes time to develop. So we have to work at this. We have to fight against that rush. Levine says there are no shortcuts to knowing our children well. That is so true. Warmth is cultivated when we take time, when we linger with our children. We have to observe and we got to spend time with them. When we get to know them in the most intimate and specific ways we can. Dates with your children is really, I would highly recommend that because you can gain a lot with that by spending that time with them. So this is what we're aiming for, that optimal connection, that warmth. So what is bad warmth? Over-involvement, intrusion, enmeshment, and bad praise. And I'm going to briefly go through these. Over-involvement, the belief in that is if involvement is good, then over-involvement must be better. No. Levine says over-involvement is not simply more healthy involvement. Rather, it's involvement that can get in the way of a child development. I tend to think of over-involvement as things we do for our kids. The forgotten dishes that we wash, the unmade beds that we straighten, the editing we do on our child's writing assignments. There's been times where I have, as a teacher, assignments come in and I'm like, this is not the kid's writing. I can tell. So I've changed it where I have all their writing done in my class because I know it's coming from them. But what drives this? What drives this over-involvement is the parental angst. And what is that? It's like a feeling of deep anxiety or dread. Am I doing enough for my child? Another author calls it enabling. When you parent like this, or when you have this kind of over-involvement, then your goal has shifted from what is best for the kid, and it's more about you. You know, how am I being a good parent? It focuses on that rather than what does my child need? Intrusion is very similar to over-involvement. Levine says intrusion invades the child's developing psychological space and blurs the appropriate and necessary boundaries between parent and child. What's the parent's responsibility? What's the child's responsibility? Invariably, to the child's disadvantage. I did this with my child on that whole issue of dishes. Okay, when Jenny was a teenager, she'd bring her friends home and totally trash the kitchen and leave it. And this would go on and on and on. And it bothered me, and I'd say, you know, we had a rule in our house, you got to do the dishes. If you make a mess, you clean it up. And they'd be stacking up, you know, I'd have no dishes left. And so I would be doing them. That's intrusion. Don't do that. Finally, I came to a solution. I'm not doing this anymore. They're not going to stack up in my kitchen. They're going to stack up in her bedroom. And so I just started, any mess that was found, carried it, stuck it on her bed. She finally did the dishes. It was great. Took a while, though. I was intruding before. It was keeping her from developing. as a young lady. Other examples of intrusion is like not knocking on the door. You know, when your kids are in elementary, they start to want privacy. And when they shut that door, you should knock and respect that. Don't just barge in because you're the parent. That's intrusion. Or fighting their battles for them. They need to learn how to fight. If they need to talk to a teacher or another person to resolve a conflict, they need to do that. You don't do that. Or do their homework. Or write their papers. That's intrusion. That's not healthy. So here's a question for us to discuss. How do you think this involvement and intrusion, over-involvement and intrusion, would retard your child's development? What are different ways? Anyone? Okay, it's going to erode their confidence. Good. Okay, they're going to be totally dependent, and we don't want that. We want them to start to be independent. Right. So what's that going to do when later in life? They're going to think this doesn't have a consequence when I do this kind of thing. Good. Very good. Yeah. They're going to get very insecure and not feel like they're capable of doing anything. Good. Yeah. Good. Good answers. All right. So enmeshment. This one is where boundaries between the parent and child are totally collapsed. This is driven by parents' unmet needs. And you often see this in a single-parent home. I came from a single-parent home. My mom tried to fight against this, but it can happen often when there's an unmet need there. This is why being involved in a home church is really key. Struggling marriages can also fall into this, you know, if the parents aren't willing to work out their conflicts. Often when the parent does not have good adult relationships, there can be some enmeshment in your relationship with your kids. Growing up, I was in a church, and there was this family that had two daughters, and the parents were not resolving conflicts. They weren't working with each other, trying to resolve. And each one would go to one of the daughters and talk about the other parent. And the girls ended up being alcoholics and drug addicted because the stress that it was causing, they never learned how to develop their own development because they were trying to help their parents. We don't want that. All right, bad praise. What? Praise can be bad? Yes. Some types of praise is bad. This was a shock to me, and this is something I just learned in the last year. I was doing things, you'll see. Praising intelligence or natural abilities rather than praising effort. When we just praise their intelligence or their natural abilities, then we're causing them to not take risks because they can't control that. This book it's called Nurture Shock. And they say this, the presumption, they did a lot of studies, and this is some of the research they found. The presumption that if a child believes he's smart, having been told repeatedly, he won't be intimidated by new academic challenges. But the constant praise is meant to be like an angel on their shoulder saying, yeah, go, woo-woo, you know, don't sell your talent short. But what they found is a growing body of research found that strongly suggests that it might be the other way around. Giving kids the label of smart does not prevent them from underperforming. It might actually cause them to underperform because if you're telling them you are really smart, well, then that sets them up for what if they fail? What if they don't understand something? Oh, they're not smart anymore. And it causes them to be insecure. In following up interviews, Dweck, however you say his name, discovered that those who think that innate intelligence is the key to success begin to discount the importance of effort. And don't you need your child to be always learning and growing in effort? I'm smart, the kid's reasoning goes. I don't need to put out effort because I'm just there. I've arrived. It's bad. So do we never praise our children? No. We need to. There's such thing as good praise, and it's praising their effort. Daniel, he's 21, he's at OSU. he'd send us this text saying, I got a 91 or whatever on my chemistry exam. And until I found this out, I was saying, oh, you are so smart. And so Joe's like, you need to read this. So I read it, and it's like, oh, no, good effort. Good job. I'm glad you worked hard. Be specific. So we need to be specific on, you know, not just a general vague, because that's not going to mean anything to them. And we need to be sincere. Kids see through when you are BSing them. They'll be like, they'll never hear your praise or take it in. Emphasizing effort gives a child a variable that they can control. This is why we need to emphasize the effort. She explains, they come to see themselves as in control of their success. Emphasizing natural intelligence takes it out of the child's control, and it provides no good recipe for responding to a failure. So, good point. Joe's going to come up and talk about low discipline and high discipline.
Okay, thanks. Yeah, on that, Levine has also done research on the idea of nurture shock. And what they're saying, too, is that if you only praise intelligence and natural gifting, that it stifles kids' creativity. They don't want to try something new because they're afraid if they fail at that new thing they try, then that must mean that they're not smart or gifted. And, of course, their ego can't handle that. And so the authors are pretty insistent that it's what you do praise is effort. You praise effort. And after all, isn't that the most important thing anyways? Yeah. So let's talk about discipline. The goal of discipline is to develop healthy, independent people by the time they're 18, 19, 20. And I think these days it kind of gets extended out a little bit farther. But that is the goal. We want them to have a high degree of freedom, a high degree of independence, and low external control. I mean, we do not want to be asking our 18-year-old, did you brush your teeth tonight? Do we? No, we don't. Now, on the other end, when the kids are very young and toddlers, that's when they do need, we don't want to give them a high degree of freedom. They should have low freedom, low independence, and we need to exert a high degree of external control on their lives. That's why we are the parents and they are the children, and they need to listen to us. And the idea is that as your children get older, then you release some of that control, you give them more freedom, more independence as time goes on, and then hopefully by the time they're 18, they'll be making their own solid decisions, they'll be a healthy individual with good, strong relationships. That's the idea. But what I have noticed over the last couple decades, and even in our fellowship, is we have a lot of parents who are very permissive at the young age. They give them a high amount of freedom and independence and don't monitor them and try to control them. But those parents are thinking, well, they're going to have to learn these skills anyways when they get older, so we might as well start teaching them now. And hopefully when they're 18, they'll be right there where they should be. But that's not the way it works. That's the way it works. If you're a permissive parent, then when the kids are older, they don't have freedom. They cannot say no to themselves. They're really not independent. And they need external control, but by that time, it's too late. We've had so many parents try to get in there and control their 15-year-old brat, and by that time, it's just too late. And they come, and they ask, what can I do? And I tell them, I don't know. I don't know. And so when they are young, that is the time. And yeah, they're adult kids who are actually babies. And so don't do this. We want to discipline kids when they're younger. You want to be in control when they're younger. That's the way you want to do it. Now, it doesn't work out as evenly as this, does it? Parents who tend to be on this side would be considered permissive parents. And that's too permissive, too much freedom, too early. And so, you know, this is a bit nuanced, but you want to avoid that. Parents on this side of the spectrum are going to be too authoritarian, and you also want to avoid that because this is going to cause rebellion and going underground and anger and just a horrible relationship with your parents. So you want to avoid that tendency as well. Let's remember this, though. Most of us have young toddlers, young kids at home. Let's remember what the Proverbs have to say. Poverty and shame will come to him who neglects discipline, but he who regards reproof will be honored. And then in Proverbs 23, verse 13, do not hold back discipline from the child. Although you beat him with a rod, he will not die. I'm not sure about the beating language, but I think there is a time and a place for spanking. Now, of course, we want to undergird our discipline with love. This is what Levine said. We can learn all kinds of techniques for disciplining, but they are bound to fail unless, at the heart, we have a loving relationship with our child. Love is the basis. That is our foundation. It undergirds our relationship. That's a steel girders that are constructed before the that undergird the bridge, the highway bridge. And in much the same way, discipline has to be undergirded with love, although otherwise it's just going to collapse, just like a bridge would collapse without steel undergirders. So we need to have good warmth with our kids. Is disciplining our kids difficult? Yes. Is it needed? Absolutely. Levine says, this is not to say we won't have moments of profound disappointment or anger. We most certainly will. We will also have moments of absolutely hating our role as bad cop, as the parent who is paying attention, setting limits, defining consequences, and in the process, incurring our children's anger. Sometimes that's the hardest part, isn't it? When your kids are just throwing all kinds of anger at you because you're disciplining them. You're so unfair. Jimmy's mom isn't like this. Hard to take. But we've got to be there. We've got to be there strong for our kids. Our kids do not need our weakness. They need our strength. So disciplining our kids is mandatory. We cannot shrink back on our responsibility there. Levine says that busy parents already feel guilty about the little time they have to spend with their children. Few of them want to waste time in conflict and anger, and as a result are often only too happy to sidestep discipline issues. The unfortunate result is that children do not learn how to take responsibility, control their impulses, or be thoughtful. So discipline at these younger ages is very, very important. Now let's talk about bad discipline. Criticism. Unhealthy criticism. This is where you are focusing on cutting down the person rather than critiquing their behavior. And as children get older, it's easier and easier to fall into this kind of bad criticism. It's a little bit, it's not as common when the kids are very young, 1 and 2 years old. Don't do that. Don't be an idiot. Bad criticism. Don't do that. Don't be an idiot. Subtle criticism is just as bad, maybe worse. Here's an example. You know, say the kid is 5 years old. Well, your cousin can write her R's. Why can't you? And I think this is even worse than the previous kind of criticism. This cuts down the person, and it's not healthy. Levine says, you would be so... Oh, she gives an example. Oh, honey, you would be so cute if you just lost 10 pounds so you could wear those little tank tops all the other girls are wearing, said by a size 4 mom with eating problems herself who can't bear the idea that her daughter's body type is stocky, not svelte. Bad criticism. No matter how delicate or oblique you think you are being, statements like these are clear declarations that your child is not good enough. And so it's important for us to think through when we do give our child some form of correction, we do it the right way. Why do you suppose parents criticize like this? What do you think is underneath those kind of statements?
Insecurity.
Insecurity? Can you build on that?
I think growing up, my mom was upset that was insecure about her body type. So she would pick on me, which would, in her mind, seem loving, but it's based on her insecurity about her weight.
Yes, I feel bad about my weight and the way I am, and I don't want you to go there, so these comments are made out of insecurity. They're made out of weakness. Good. Yeah, Jeff. Okay, so part of this might be sort of a shortcut. We're trying to shame them into changing. Good. Yes.
I guess I get the mic front. I think like a lot of taking a lot of identity and security, insecurity from our kids' performance. Comparing them. I already see myself comparing my children to each other. So, yeah.
Yeah, and so again, this is out of insecurity. You're comparing with other kids. You see other kids might be advancing more than yours. And so then you just start lunging and doing what you can to try to get your kids to move over here and not be where they're at. Good. Yes.
I think our true values just tend to come out. So even if we, in our better moments, know, I wouldn't want to actually do that, it's just going to be expressed because that's what we actually value.
Yes, and so that's why it's so important to get our values from God and from what the Bible teaches. Good. And I think you're all right on that. Great points. Levine says, criticism is a way to divert us from our own disappointments and project them instead onto our children. It's a place where parenting can turn ugly, and how we've seen that. And I did this with one of my children early on, and I was parenting out of insecurities, and I really think that I harmed her. There was one time at a park, her sister was climbing up the jungle gym just like a monkey, and my other daughter was a bit more fearful and not really taking risks. And I was just like, oh, look at your sister, how, you know, she's like a monkey and you're not, you know, and it's just really ugly, and I didn't want her to be that way. I wanted her to be strong, bold, but that wasn't her personality. And I actually think I harmed her in that way. This is a great psalm to meditate on, I think, as an antidote. Psalm 139, you've read this before. You made all the delicate inner parts of my body and knit me together in my mother's womb. Thank you for making me so wonderfully complex. Your workmanship is marvelous. How well I know it. That's our kids. They are marvelously made. God knew what he was doing. Let us not try to turn them into somebody they are not. Let us risk comparing. And let us parent out of strength, knowing that God has got our back. Criticism is bad warmth. We need to undergird our relationship with love in connection, not with bad criticism. Another form of bad discipline is, it has to do with this notion of our approach when to the motive or to the intent of the child. Did this child do something wrong because it was just childish irresponsibility, or was it willful defiance? And it's important to distinguish between the two before we discipline. This all comes from Dr. James Dobson. Dare to Discipline, get that book, or The Strong-Willed Child is another good book by James Dobson. I think he really has a good handle on this. Childish irresponsibility. A kid is, you know, he's happy, he's running around, he's exuberant, he hits the table and the milk falls over. And are you going to come down on this? How hard are you going to come down on this? He's so excited, and he got some really good news. He's running all over the place, hits the table, the dish falls off, the real nice dish, it breaks. What are you going to do? How hard are you going to come down on him? Or is it that defiant, no, I'm not, no, mommy. What do you do about that? Childish irresponsibility. These we must handle gently with understanding. Our kids are kids. They are irresponsible. And we should not come down on them in anger for childish irresponsibility. Oh my God, do you realize how much that costs? Now we're going to have to take time, go to the store. We don't have the money. You know, the kid already feels bad enough for breaking the dish. He doesn't need that. He needs understanding. How many times have you had to go back and apologize after losing your temper like that over something stupid? I'd say 100 times maybe or more. Instead, why don't we use childish irresponsibility as an opportunity for training? How about that? Okay, Jimmy, let's see how we can fix this together. I'll get the glue and we'll try to put this dish back together. Instead, you know what? You're used to getting rewards and you buy your ice cream with those rewards every week. How about instead we use your reward money to buy a replacement rather than for ice cream? And so you're doing a lot of things here. You're teaching them how to be responsible. You're teaching them natural consequences. You're not losing their temper. They don't feel like you're mad at them. And now they become a part of the solution. And so I think this is the way to go. This is what Randy Alcorn says from Money, Possessions, and Eternity. I think that's the book title. When a child loses or breaks a toy, a parent who feels sorry for the child will often replace the toy with a new one. Meanwhile, the child is deprived of learning the way life functions. You must care for things because there are consequences to having them lost or broken. If the consequences are removed, the wrong lesson is learned. It's okay to be careless because you get what you want anyways. And so let's approach childish irresponsibility with an opportunity for them to learn life's lessons and resist anger. Now, willful defiance is a totally different matter. This is when the kid, okay, let's just give some examples. This is when the kid refuses to accept parental leadership. Now, that is something you discipline. You have to be in control. What are some examples? Let's just throw out some examples of defiance. Okay, right. And so they're going to go and then touch the outlet with a knife in their hand. Completely ignoring. Yes, some kids are real good at that. Good. Yeah, you've got to get that kid and you put him and you look, you know, you are looking me in the eyes. You will not do that. Other ideas. How about when you're walking down the street and the kid just runs off. This is a two-year-old, two-and-a-half-year-old, runs off, and you say, get back here, stay with mommy. And he looks back and he's like, goes the other way. No, you have to get in control and make that kid be with you. Yeah, this is no time to be weak. We have to get control of that child's will. We have to be strong. It requires a strong response. The child needs to know who is in charge. And by God, if your kid is in charge, that's not going to work in your household. I mean, that's just like giving, you know, a 2 or 3 year old a gun or a knife. I mean, it's going to be dangerous for everybody involved. Okay, here's another kind of bad discipline, psychological control. We need to resist that. Levine says, now, behavioral control includes being an authority, making age-appropriate demands, setting limits, and monitoring children's behavior. However, psychological control is characterized by two elements. It intrudes into the psychological world of the child, and it attempts to manipulate the child's thoughts and feelings by invoking guilt, shame, and anxiety. The hallmark of psychological control is that it is non-responsive to the child's emotional and psychological needs, and it puts more focus on the parental needs and desires and not the child's. Let's look at some examples. Our son Daniel, when he was in, I think, early elementary school, he was real excitable, and so he was always, he took the bus, and he was always getting out of his seat. And the bus driver sent a note home, like, if your child keeps getting out of his seat and talking with his friends, he's not going to be able to ride the bus anymore. And so you could, this would be an example of psychological control. I just got a note from the bus driver. You are making me look like a bad parent. Why can't you stay in your seat? Stop being so hyper. And so you are cutting down. You are getting in there and manipulating your kid, saying, you are making me look bad. And so now your needs have elevated above the child's needs. Rather, shouldn't we say something more like this? Sorry you had such a difficult time staying in your seat on the bus. Now, if you continue getting out of your seat, you will be kicked off the bus and you won't be riding with your friends anymore. How are you going to like that? Is that something you want? Because that's going to happen if you keep getting out of your seat. And we won't be kicking you off the bus. The bus driver will. Got to make someone else the bad guy. And furthermore, we will need to take you an hour earlier because we have to go on our schedule now, and you're going to have to get up an hour earlier. We're going to have to drop you off at school an hour earlier. Is that what you want? You always make it hard for me. What's wrong with you? You don't care about me at all, nor the hassle it's going to cause me. That is psychological control. Behavioral control is different. The good parent will say, what are things you can do or think about that'll help you stay in your seat? Let's think that through, Jimmy. Which friends, do you have any friends who can help you, that can remind you to stay in your seat? Not, do you have friends that will keep you in your seat? Maybe you can put your book bag on your lap so that when you get up, your book bag comes off and you realize, oh God, I'm getting out of my seat. I better put my book, you know. What solutions can we come up with, Daniel, to keep you in your seat? This is something my mom used to pull on me, which I did not like. I remember I was 8 years old, and it was her birthday, and I did not make her a homemade birthday card that year. And she said, you didn't make me a birthday card this year. I was so hurt. After all I've done for you, you are so ungrateful. And then I got the silent treatment for a day. 8 years old. Yuck. Rather, you know, I did miss your card this year. You're always so creative. That's okay. Maybe Mother's Day next month. And so something a lot more light than that. Yeah. Levine says, not surprisingly, behavioral control has positive effects on child and adolescent development, while psychological control has consistently been shown to have negative effects. Parents who use behavioral control are in control. I was just kidding. Effective discipline has clear, firm, and reasonable boundaries. It's easier on both parents and kids when parents have developed a general discipline strategy, one that is clear, firm, and fair, and that eliminates endless discussions about what is and isn't okay in your particular household. Yes, clear, firm, and fair, and I might add reasonable boundaries there. Be careful not to pile on too much responsibility. It's perfectly reasonable for kids to pick up their toys at the end of the day and put them away. Maybe their house job every day is to clear the dishes off the table, feed the dog, something along those lines. But be careful not to pile too much onto the kids. Effective discipline also has follow-through. Levine says, firm control needs to be established early in a child's life. If you say you can't bike ride with your friends today because you were reckless on your bike yesterday, you need to mean it. There's nothing to be gained by idle threats and everything to be lost. No doubt about that. Every psychiatrist and psychologist I spoke with over the course of writing this book mentioned a lack of firm limit setting as one of the major contributors to adolescent dysfunction. Kids want and need limits is a common refrain among professionals who deal with troubled and not so troubled kids. Setting firm limits. Screen time. Are we going to really let them watch TV 4 hours a day and or be on their phone or their little device 3-4 hours a day? Really? No, we need to set firm limits there and stick to those limits. What are you going to be your limits when it comes to homework versus play? Do they do their homework right when they get from school? Do you let them play for an hour and then do their homework? Set firm, consistent limits, firm, consistent boundaries. Be consistent. That's important because if you're inconsistent, then that creates a lot of insecurity on the kids because they don't know what to expect. Do you have firm limits on your bedtime? Or is it all over the place? I would recommend firm boundaries with bedtime. When our kids were very young, 1, 2, 3 years old, something like that, we had an old friend with their family over, and their kids were about the same age as our kids. We had them over at about 5 o'clock for dinner, and it was great. You know, the kids are playing together, and it came to 8 o'clock, and it was about time for us to put down our kids, and we did. And of course, this other family, we thought, oh, they'll probably take off now too so they can go home and put their kids down. Nerp! They hung out, and I thought, all right, well, they were having a great time, so they'll probably stay for a little while longer. It got to be 9 o'clock. They hadn't left. Their kids are starting to get a little bit whiny, but they didn't leave, and they kept talking. The kids, and it turned out to be, then it got to be 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock. Their kids are a mess. Our kids are sleeping in their beds. Their kids are just running around. Their eyes are just red. And Cindy and I are just looking at each other like, what is happening here? This is insane. They did not leave until 1 a.m., and they're just like, yeah, the kids are looking like they're kind of tired. Duh. Firm limits, consistent limits. This was also a family that didn't believe in set meal times. They would just feed their kid whenever their kid was hungry. And so this, yeah, this was like anything goes as a parent, you know. This is important, too, regarding setting limits. It's a lot more difficult to set limits with a strong-willed child rather than a compliant child. Compliant children will just do it, no problem. They love to follow orders. They love to obey. That's what they learned in the womb. I don't know. James Dobson says, second, I have found that the parents of compliant children don't understand their friends with defiant youngsters. They intensify guilt and embarrassment by implying, if you would just raise your kids the way I do mine, you wouldn't be having these awful problems. May I say to both groups that willful children can be difficult to manage even when parents handle their responsibilities with great skill and dedication. It may take several years to bring such a youngster to a point of relative obedience and cooperation within the family unit. And indeed, a strong-willed child will be a strong-willed individual all her life. How true. Let us not stand piously over our friends who have strong-willed kids. It's uncool. During the childhood years, it's important for parents to not panic. Don't try to fix your tougher boy or girl overnight. Treat that child with sincere love and dignity, but require him or her to follow your leadership. You do have, okay, you may have a strong-willed child. Who in this room has a strong-willed child? A lot of hands went up. This is not an excuse to let them have their way and to go easy. You have to get control and win on your child. They have to have a basic understanding that they have to obey you. Otherwise, there is going to be hell to pay in their lives if they don't. They have to get that message. You're the captain. They are the private. I know friends of mine with a defiant kid, and when this kid was about two and a half years old, we were all at the beach, and this kid would not listen to Dad. He kept going out in the water, and it was time to go, and Dad kept saying, no, come on, we have to go. It's time to go. And the kid would look back and just march the other way, and no. And so the dad was like, well, I guess it's time to introduce spanking. And this kid was, you know, they went on and were arguing this before the spanking. They were arguing for, you know, a good 15, 20 minutes. And the dad finally realized, all right, it's time for a spank. So he spanked the kid, and the kid was just like, what just happened? Oh, my God. And he's looking up at Dad like, and Dad was like, are you ready to go? And the kid just marched right along, ready to go. Yes, you have to mean business as a parent. This is good for the child. This is what they need. This is going to help them become a mature, responsible, independent person when they're 18 years old. If you don't do this, they will grow up to be very infantile, demanding, and very dependent on other people to have their needs met. Be in control. Various studies have found that firm parental control is associated with children who can take care of themselves, who are academically successful, and who are emotionally well-developed, and who are happier. Spanking, appropriate spanking, not out of anger, but in control. Spanking, discipline, produces a healthier kid. Now, I'm not saying you're just total command authority all the time, and you relinquish that control as the kid gets older. But when they are young, this is especially important. Another kind of effective discipline is containment and monitoring, and here's what I mean by this. You need to know where your kids are. Make them report in. Maybe your kids are in elementary school and they're starting to hang out with the neighborhood kids. You need to know who they're with, how long they're going to be with that person, where they're going to be, and if they're even allowed to do that. So we need to monitor our kids. We need to contain our kids. There is... This is 20-some years ago. Zenon's family, they had a kid, and this kid was in junior high, and the parents were just letting that kid run around with a known high school drug dealer. And we brought that to the parents, and like, don't you know who this kid is that your own junior high kid is hanging out with? Yeah, I know he's got problems, but I'm sure my kid will make good choices, my junior high kid. No, he will not make good choices. And, of course, that Zenos kid is, ruined. He's a basket case. Containment and monitoring. We need to monitor how our kids are treating their siblings. We need to make our home a safe place. And if our kids, if our older kids are just mistreating their younger siblings, we need to get a hold of that and deal with that. Okay, that's what we have, and you may have a couple questions right now, and we can entertain just some questions for a couple minutes at this point, but after that, then here's a couple discussion questions for your discussion groups. What parenting style were you raised with, and which ones do you tend to use? Second question, do you have an area of weakness with connection or discipline that is driven by a faulty belief or insecurity that you have? So in a little bit, we'll break up into discussion groups, and you can discuss those questions. Are there any questions? Come on up, Cindy. Does anybody? Yes. Okay, sure. Come on up, Cindy.
I'm sure this is in a book somewhere, but if a kid is lying and you kind of know it and you're like, okay, in our family we tell the truth, tell me the truth, and then, you know, within 30 seconds or something, they confess the truth. Do you praise that or do you discipline the lying? We get into this like dilemma where we're like, if we basically discipline them for coming out and confessing that they lied, could that teach them don't confess?
Yeah, I think my approach would first to make sure they understand why lying is destructive and why trust is so important, and that we need to be able to trust them, and that lying erodes that trust. And if they're going to continue to lie, there will be a discipline. So I think to begin with, maybe go a little bit easier on them and explain to them why telling the truth is so important in the relationship, and make it a relational discussion, a discussion about relationship. But then if they continue to do it, then I think I would probably start to discipline, start lightly, and then increase the discipline the more they keep lying. Because if your kid... if your kid becomes a liar, then you have no chance at having a relationship with them. You can't.
You can also, I've done this before, I don't know. You know, they confess, you can say, you know, this would have been your discipline if you wouldn't have confessed. But this discipline I'm going to do because it's still bad that you lied, but it's going to be a lighter discipline.
That's a great
point. I've done that
good
before.
Yes?
I just had a question about, I think I struggle with, like, having a vision for our kids, but, like, not being frustrated when what they're doing doesn't fit. Or, like, you know, I don't know, like, just how to not, like, I think when they're, like, I was thinking about lying. I think all of our kids when they were five started lying. With my first kid, I was freaking out because I'm like, he's going to be a liar. And by the third one, you're like, oh, they're five, they're lying, you know. So I think I can sometimes discipline out of fear of what this sin is going to look like in a number of years rather than, like, this is where my kid is at. And so I don't know if you have a response to, like, having a vision for their growth and God's, you know, purpose for them, and also just accepting who they are and where they are.
Well, I think on the vision part, yes, I mean, our vision gets attacked all the time, and the devil will see to it they're not going to make it, and he'll speak a lot of negative lies to you, and he's trying to cause you to be rash. And he wants you to discipline out of weakness and out of fear when we really need to be disciplining out of strength. And so it's needs to be more about the child than it is about us. And I think when the kid is lying, we have to say, now, if you're going to continue to lie and not be truthful with me, this is going to be the trajectory of your life. And so give them a negative vision. But I have better plans for you, and God has better plans for you. If you start telling the truth, you're going to see God come through for you in this and this and this way. So give them a negative vision and a positive vision. And if they continue to lie, you do have to discipline them. That might be a timeout. That might be a spank. That might be part of their allowance money they get gets taken away. Our middle child was a stealer. So she always used to steal her sister's little toys and then lie just like a thief about it. And, no, I didn't take it. And then you'd find the stuff, her sister's
under
stuff, her bed, you know, stashed somewhere. And then she would finally come out with the truth. And so we would have to discipline her. We'd have to spank her or some other form of discipline. So, yeah, they are going to lie. Kids are great at lying. Mm-hmm. Yes. Right in the back over here. Okay.
Oh, sorry. I have an 18-month-old, and we live in a cul-de-sac, and our neighbors, like, play basketball. They kick the ball around, so that's, like, an area to play. But that's the street. But that's not the main street. I don't want to teach him that he can run in the street. He was like kicking, he was pretending to kick the ball with the neighbors. And the today, actually, he looked back at me, smiled, laughed, and ran towards the street. But I don't want him to think that he can play and run in the street, but I want him to be able to play in the street. Like, it's, what would you, where's the boundary for that?
You want this one?
Well, when they're 18 months, you're with them. And I know, we live in a cul-de-sac too. So I don't know. I think as they get older, you can explain it more. As an 18-month-old, you can just communicate, Mommy needs to be with you when you're out here.
And I don't let her run towards the street, but if I'm out there, I let
you. You run with them.
I would.
I'm going to run with you.
I would. I would try to train him to look both ways and see if a car's coming.
Because cars.
So before he hits the pavement, he's got to stop. Here's the pavement. And you know that might teach him a little bit of self-control. So he can't just dart out into the court. He has to stop.
Good point.
Where the cul-de-sac starts, you know, in your yard. Yeah. I think there's a legitimate case for that, you know.
Especially if he looked back, like he knew.
Yeah, I think that's a...
that's usually a sign.
Yeah.
Testing the boundary.
Yes.
I was wondering what you think some examples might be of a toddler with too much independence. Like you gave the graph of if you start with too much independence, then you actually end up with no independence, kid living in your basement when they're 30. And I would like to know an example of what a toddler with too much independence might look like.
Okay, I have one.
You go.
Okay. One is giving the toddler choices of what he's going to eat for lunch or dinner. Or if you're on the run, is it going to be McDonald's or Burger King? I think you pick, he's got to live with your choice. I've seen parents where, you know, they'll just spend 5 or 10 minutes trying to discuss with him what he's going to eat for lunch, and I wouldn't entertain that myself.
Or bedtimes, they usually want to argue, or not, you know, like, you set the bedtime of what you want for a toddler, not the toddler telling, you know, that showing with their actions that they don't want that bedtime, because they don't know, they need that control on them. I would say also when you're like when you're with other kids, with like when you're, you know, you got families together, you set limits there on how they can treat other kids. Not having boundary or not,
yeah,
you know, would be like just letting them, oh, it's, you know, that's just the stage you're going through. No, you're going to take action when you see them hit the other kid or when you see that kind of thing. I don't know.
Yeah, and you're at the grocery store and the kid wants a certain type of cereal and you don't want them to have that type of cereal and they throw a fit. You know, that might be the time for some sterner discipline at that point.
Is that answering your question? Okay.
So I have a question about the spanking. And I don't think you guys are saying that this is hands down the only way of discipline.
Right.
But there's a lot of back and forth in our culture about whether to spank or not to spank, and probably even in this room.
Right.
And I guess I was wondering, do you think that other forms of punishment are as effective? And also, if you are doing spanking, what's kind of the best way to be doing that? Because I know for myself, I spank and it's out of anger usually, so I don't let myself do it. I let my husband do it when they get home and they have that threat hanging over their heads, you know? But like, so, but yeah, those two things, I guess.
Yeah, well, I'll mention a couple things. But spanking, I don't think there's strong, credible evidence that healthy spanking is going to ruin your kid. Healthy spanking is infrequent, it's in control, and what you find is when it's under control, and when you're not using it for everything, kids end up appreciating it. They crawl up on your lap afterwards. They hug you. I do not think it's damaging at all to the kid. And I think it can be very helpful. Spanking out of control when you're angry is bad, like you mentioned. Every time the kid turns around, he gets a spank. I don't think that's healthy either. I think timeouts can be good. Mm-hmm. It depends on what speaks to your kid the most.
Yeah.
We would give our oldest kid a timeout. She didn't care.
She loved
to be alone.
Timeouts.
So we realized that didn't work. So we had to do something else. We had to take something away.
And then with our more social one, she wanted the spank because that was quick and over, and a timeout killed her. So we did the timeouts with her because that was more effective. So you gotta have to kind of figure out what works.
Yeah.
With your kid. I say we didn't spank very often. It was more for those, huge, like, defiance.
Yeah, willful defiance.
We held it out for something that was really, like, things that were, like, spilled milk or stuff like that or, whatever. We didn't spank on that.
Yeah, I think willful defiance, you probably have a couple options with discipline, but I think spanking is certainly one of those options.